Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome via ITV to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is March 6th, and we have two matters, both by ITV, remaining on our oral calendar this morning. Can we just check in and have everyone say a few words so we make sure the ITV equipment's working?
Your Honor, my name is Dave McLaughlin, and I'm in Big Stone.
Welcome, Mr. McLaughlin.
Thank you.
Your Honor, my name is Mark Granger. I'm in Polk County, Minnesota.
Thank you both. So,
Your Honor, this is Lisa Bean. I'm in the Centennial Building. There's another attorney here with me.
Great. And I understand that counsel for appellants, you're splitting your time this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor. Greg Deardall will have 5 minutes, and the trust will have 10 minutes.
Great. Thank you. Marshall, will you make sure we get that set up? So each side will have 15 minutes. Then counsel for appellant, one of you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. I'd ask you to reintroduce yourself when you come to the podium so it's clear on our tape. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Your Honor, we understood there was another case instead of us first. The Deardall case wasn't first. There was another one. That's incorrect. I'll just start then.
So on our schedule, the Deardall case was listed first.
Yes.
Well,
that's my understanding.
Okay. Then may it please the Court, Your Honor, I will start on behalf of Greg Deardall. I have 5 minutes, and basically, this case revolves around a written lease with the option to purchase. The option to purchase was not with the proper party. The proper party was a trustee, but that was unknown to my clients. So we went through a trial court. The first case, there was an issue whether slander of title for the lease, which was recorded by my client without the assistance of Mr. McDowell. And then Mr. McDowell filed a notice of lis pendens, but the notice of lis pendens was defective. The problems in both of those cases, the trial court, Judge Remick, found that the notice of lis pendens was invalid. The option to purchase was okay, probably, because he found it was a sublease, but there was a provision in there for an option to purchase, which he found was invalid. We went through the first trial. Damages were awarded against Mr. Deardall for slander of title, and we subsequently brought an action against Mr. McDowell, who represented Mr. Deardall when the case was first commenced and through August of 2011. And that's important because the damages were limited in the underlying case to rental property, rental claims from 2011. There was a motion for summary judgment. Summary judgment was awarded against us. And I understand the basis for that is that we did not ask the first trial court or to apportion the damages between the lease and a notice of lis pendens. In our perspective, that was irrelevant to the first court. The question, was there slander of title? The jury answered yes, didn't say which one it was, and we were assessed damages as a result of that. So we believe that we should have our chance to have a jury determine which of the two causes of action were the cause of the damages. And that's why we're here today.
The counsel for your client could have asked that as part of the special verdict form in the underlying trial, correct?
Correct. We did not do so. But we still believe we should get the chance to do that, because in that case it didn't make any difference on what the damages were or not between the two causes.
But right now, is it fair to say that right now that you don't have that proof of causation because it wasn't apportioned?
We don't have it now, but we could go to this jury and apportion it because they were never asked to determine which was the event which caused the damages. We were hamstrung because we were forced to admit that Mr. McDowell's work was defective and he prepared it on our behalf. That caused us, we believe, significant problems with the first verdict. So that's why we did not ask for the court to be apportioned. We believe it's proper to do it in this case as opposed to apportion it when it's not necessary in the other case. So I don't know if the court has any other questions. Otherwise, we'll reserve and go on from there. I think the court understands the issue.
How would you prove that in a new case? Would you be asking the jury what they would have done in the first case? Isn't the issue what the jury did in the first case?
No, what we would do is we would put on evidence regarding this is the lease, this is what the problem is with the lease, and we would put on the specific notice of list pendants, show the specific problems that were there. It was totally defective on the part of Mr. McDowell. The case wasn't filed, the wrong county was listed, there wasn't served. And that's what caused the problem in our mind. And the jury.
How would that tell us anything about what the previous jury believed?
It would not tell you anything regarding that, Your Honor.
Isn't that the thing that we need to understand now?
No, I believe we can do it based upon we have the two causes. We know what they were. One of them was my client's, and one of them was Mr. McDowell's. So then it comes out where should the damage?
Isn't the issue in this case whether the outcome in the previous case would have been somehow changed?
No, because the damages in that case were specifically established based on both cases from the 2011 damages. So that first case wouldn't change. Didn't make any difference what the decision was. It's what would happen in this one, because the issue of what was the cause was not relevant in that case because the court could determine it. They just said, was there slander of title? Yes.
Okay, thank you.
That was the answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Collectively, you'll have 5 more minutes for rebuttal. Yep. Counsel for the trust.
Representing the trustees, James Wallenberg and Susan Huerta, who are co-trustees of their late father's trust. And throughout these proceedings, that's referred to as the Wallenberg Family Trust. My clients are seeking the following relief. First, they're looking to reverse the summary judgment decision of the district court, which was based on the slander of title claim. The court found there was undisputed that Mr. McDowell did not act maliciously when he recorded a notice of list pendants. Secondly, my clients are asking to reverse the denial of their motion in district court to amend the complaint to add a punitive damages claim. The district court denied both of these based on belief that Mr. McDowell had acted in good faith. And so both of these claims are related to that. The reason for reversal here is largely hinges on a case which is Virtue versus Creamery Package. Now, the respondent had actually cited this case in great detail in his opening brief. And so I want to spend a couple of minutes here just talking about what that case means. What the case says is when a document or an instrument is recorded that isn't entitled to be recorded, or a false statement, in other words, that creates a rebuttable presumption of malice. And we also know from the South Cross case, the effect of that. The effect of that is the issue cannot be resolved on summary judgment. It must be proceed to a trial. To reason otherwise would create a situation where the court would have to weigh the evidence, which is impermissible in summary judgment. And so that's what we have here. First and foremost item is that Mr. McDowell recorded a document, a notice of list pendants, that had no basis of law or fact. And that is undisputed from the record. That's what the district court found. Could not record that document.
If I could stop and ask a few questions. The Virtue versus Creamery Package Manufacturing, I mean, that deals with patent law, right? With patents. Do you have any case talking about these presumed malice in Liz Pendens or, you know, another property type case?
Well, the case was based on infringement, and the court said the principles of slander of title do apply. and then explained what the principles of slander of title actually are. And throughout the proceeding, throughout the cases that Minnesota has dealt with, you can see this interweaving theme where Minnesota has actually dealt with these issues extensively. And the reason why we have this presumption, and I can start with this, the reason why we have this presumption is if someone's doing a wrongful act or recording a document in the first place, they're up to no good, or there's a presumption that they're up to no good. Because what grounds do they have for actually doing so in the first place? And so it puts the onus of them and to rebut that presumption by showing good faith. Now, this is a measure or a situation which calls for the inquiry into the mind of Mr. McDowell, and he's in control of whatever his thoughts were, and he can fashion those after the fact.
Can I just ask a question? Okay, assuming that this is good law, it says so that where there's just publication, so the Liz Pendens is the publication, is made by someone with no legal interest in the disputed property. Well, he was doing this on behalf of his client, and at that point, wasn't there a dispute? And the district court says a colorable dispute about whether Mr. Dreidel had an interest in the property?
It's based on the recording of a false statement, but also in terms of having an interest or not, there's no interest or right to record this instrument against the property because the complaint had not been filed. But on top of that, although Mr. McDowell said there was an interest, that doesn't mean there was a colorful claim. And the district court already determined in the other case, it was dismissed on summary judgment motion. There was no colorful claim. There was nothing to base it on. It was just artfully crafted complaint that had no legal merit.
I thought that there was kind of some, at least, colorable I thought the district court, but correct me if I'm wrong, was saying that there at least was a colorable claim because, you know, the trust had accepted payments or directed payments under the lease. There had been prior dealings. I mean, this did go to trial for slander of title, correct?
It did, but what did 2013? Not go to slander of title is my clients served a motion or a counterclaim against Mr. Dreidel and upon Mr. McDowell, where they had an opportunity to deal with a quiet title action. That's basically saying my client's in possession of the property and determines their adverse claims. That puts the plaintiff, Mr. Dreidel in that case, on notice where he has to plea the basis of his claim, what he claims for an interest, and lay it all out. Facts are all on the table. And that's what we see in his reply complaint. That reply complaint, his best case, and having the benefit of all discovery and summary judgment, was found that he had no claim. There was nothing there. You can't create a fictional claim out of nowhere. And this is based on, a claim that, or different theories, but it was, the primary theory would seem to be that Mr. David Wallenberg, who was a relative, purportedly acted as principal. And that's what the complaint said. But during depositions, Mr. Dreidel was pretty clear. Mr. David Wallenberg said nothing to him on this nature. He just guessed. He assumed that was the case. So this whole claim that there was some sort of a colorful interest was completely sham in the prior proceedings, and that's why it was dismissed. It was shot down. Nothing supported it.
So when we look at, assuming that there's this presumption of malice in these cases, we look at, was the publication false, and by someone with no legal interest in the disputed property, when do we measure whether someone has that legal interest in the disputed property? Do we wait until after the trial, 2.5 years later, or do we look at, was there a colorable claim at the time that the Liz Pendens was filed?
Well, it could be two ways. I mean, there's no case law that I found that looked at that, but it does look at the intention of when you're recording it.
All in this area.
I'm sorry?
I think we can agree that there's not a lot of case law and presumed malice in this area.
There isn't. One of the things is that it could be looked at as when it's recorded, whether there was a good faith basis for recording in the first place. But then if you look at the Simonson Lumber case, the court also noted in that case that the failure to actually discharge that notice of Liz Pendens when you knew it was phony and that there weren't facts to support it was actually supported grounds for bad faith filing of a slander of title claim. In that case, it was a claim of a lien. So it did look at after the fact, so because slander of title deals with surrounding circumstances. So I don't think it's just pigeoned into one time frame or another. It looks at the surrounding circumstances. It's more flexible.
And so on this presumption issue, that alone defeats summary judgment because it requires weighing the evidence. And if Mr. McDowell had a good faith claim It would have come out somehow, but it's already been disposed of. And to try to fashion after the fact facts, you know, we already know what Mr. Dirdall's, you know, basis, we know what Mr. McDowell's basis was for bringing that lawsuit, because we have the complaint, the pleadings, everything. We know what the, he was also participating in the discovery, so we know that what facts he was based on, which is nil. There's nothing to base it on except conjecture and speculation at best. And we also know what Mr. Dirdall's situation was, because he gave participated in full discovery and depositions as well. So there was nothing. But even then, if we do have to go to, if it is rebutted, for example, and where we get to this good faith analysis, the second prong of virtue, well, then we look at, you know, is it undisputed that this malice element was there was no dispute on this issue, and that there was Mr. McDowell acted in good faith? Well, issues of malice and issues of frame of mind, state of mind, are notoriously inappropriate for summary judgment motion, and that's because reasonable minds may disagree. And what we're dealing with here on a surrounding circumstances basis, Mr. McDowell would have to show the three prongs, that he had a proper occasion for recording this, a proper motive, and was reasonable or probable, with reasonable or probable cause. In other words, not in reckless disregard. And what he said is he recorded this notice of his pendants without knowing what the law was. He said he didn't even bother looking at the statute, didn't look at any case law on it. He'd filed over 50 of these notice of his pendants in the past. He's been an attorney of over 40 years, and he's a licensed or certified abstractor and an attorney in the state. And despite all of that, and when he's owned a title company, and despite that, he's recorded this notice of his pendants without having any idea, according to him, whether this thing was even entitled to be recorded. His belief at the time, so he says, was that he thought that if you give it to us, the time he gives it to a process server, a private processor at that, it's okay to record that notice of his pendants, which is great, because, but he didn't do that until afterwards, later. So his excuse shows that he did not have a good faith basis for it. That directly refutes his entire basis.
Isn't
he had none.
Faith a little different than what's required here for malice under slander of title, which is reckless disregard concerning the truth or falsity of a matter, despite a high degree of awareness of probable falsity? That seems like a much higher standard than what you're talking about.
And that's actually the third prong of the virtue case, which is the if showing the actual malice. Those are elements of actual malice. So yes, it could come to that point, but we have to resolve the second step first. And if we are dealing with the reckless disregard, he was reckless in the fact that he recorded this notice of his penance without even knowing if it was entitled to be recorded. He did no research into determining whether there was even an agency and for David Wallenberg to enter into an agreement. There was no evidence of ratification. These are all frivolous claims, and it may look great on a lawsuit, but there were no facts to base on it. And the fact that Mr. Dirdall or Mr. McDowell didn't even bother filing that lawsuit, that's evidence of he had no intention of actually going forward with it. He just wanted to bilk my clients and get the property for a significant discount.
Thank you. Counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. First of all, can everybody hear me?
We can. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Mark Granger. I represent the respondent and Larry McDowell, Lawrence McDowell, in this case. And, Your Honor, I think it's important in this case to keep a sort of a bird's eye view on this. My client made some mistakes. It's undisputed. I wish he hadn't have. They were sloppy. They caused some heartburn. Well, I don't think that they actually caused the damages, because there's no evidence that they actually caused damage. But what happened was he filed these Liz pendants. The Liz pendants was dated the same day as the summons and complaint. Shortly thereafter, he caused them to all be served. He commenced the action. It was not done in the right order. He made some mistakes. That was about the extent of his involvement. This case was then litigated for years. And as a consequence, both parties in that previous litigation want Lawrence McDowell, who filed a faulty notice of Liz Penn, to pay for everything, everybody's attorney fees, everybody's damages, everything for that. Is there really any question that the errors that are contained in that notice of Liz Penn are what caused those damages? And that's an important distinction. not whether commencing an action resulted in damages, not whether any of those things happened, but whether or not these so-called false statements, whether any damages were really caused because there was a couple day lapse between the time that the notice of Liz Penzin was recorded and the time that the action was commenced.
Could I ask a question about the underlying litigation? My understanding is that was based on some claim that came from the lease for this property. Is that correct so
yes.
far? So
yes.
Did that claim get dismissed, or did that claim actually go to trial?
Your Honor, I would first premise that by saying that by the time any of those things happened, Lawrence McDowell was not involved in it and had no say, no opportunity to argue.
Yeah,
I'm
trying to understand whether there could be a conclusion that the first lawsuit was completely frivolous and shouldn't have been filed at all.
And, Your Honor, I would also point, so in response to that specific question, the judge in the current case from which this appeal is being taken noted in many times throughout flaws in the previous determinations or the previous orders and findings by the previous judge. Even this judge was confused and was, I know that opposing counsel saying this was a meritless, frivolous case with no merit whatsoever. This judge, from which this appeal is being taken, said, wait a minute, not so fast. I think that it's even confusing. I'm not sure that the first judge got this right. She pointed out flaws in that first summary judgment motion. So to answer your question, Judge, about what first happened, I believe that there was a summary judgment that made some determinations. There was a trial, maybe just to determine damages. I'm not exactly sure on that, but I don't think that the standard of whether it failed in summary judgment or whether it failed at trial is the standard by which we determine that there is no colorable claim, and that seems to be what opposing counsel is arguing, that just because it was unsuccessful, even if it was unsuccessful at summary judgment, that doesn't mean that there wasn't a colorable claim.
Well, that's why I'm asking my question is, did this go beyond just making a claim? Is there some reason to conclude that? I mean, there was a trial earlier. But was the trial just on the slander of title claim, or was there more to it than that?
The jury made a determination, so I assume that there was a trial on the facts of whether or not there was a slander of title, because there was a special verdict form that indicated did they publish false statements? Did the document produce
right,
damages?
What I'm trying to find out is did they address the question of whether there in fact were any rights to purchase under the lease? Or is there some reason to think that under the lease there was a right to
purchase?
There
was a summary judgment determination that Judge Remick in the original litigation dismissed the claim that was originally brought and found that there was no option available. That was determined in summary judgment that Mr. Deardall did not have a right to that option. That claim was dismissed in summary judgment.
But the basis for bringing that suit initially was some belief that language in the lease gave him an option.
It wasn't just the language in the lease. There was conduct between the parties. There was later ratification conduct that ratified that lease. There was a history between these people. There were other convening circumstances. For example, Your Honor, before any of the litigation started, before Mr. Deardall attempted to exercise his option to purchase, he received a letter from an attorney for the trust and said, please direct any and all future rent payments to us, and so to the trust. And so the trust was certainly exercising or wanting to enforce the terms of that.
So there's
lease.
Some argument there that the trust was ratifying whatever agreement David Wallenberg had entered into.
That was one of the arguments as to why there was a colorable claim and why the purchase option should be enforced was because the lease, the trust did ratify that by its conduct. In other words, it can't enforce the rent, it can't enforce the terms only it wants without giving the rights that were afforded to the renter under that same document. And again, so just because that was later dismissed in summary judgment doesn't mean that's not the standard, that there was no good faith belief that there was a colorable claim at the time that the notice of Liz Penzin was recorded and the lawsuit was commenced. Your Honor, I would point out that a lot has been made about the timing that the that the notice of list pendants and the action was commenced. Opposing counsel points to the timing of this, that it was only done after the notice or the lease was brought to the trust's attention, and only after the option purchased option was rejected by the seller or the trust, and only after only after they indicated that they were going to proceed with another buyer. Your Honor, I we do a lot of this, and unfortunately, you got a small window. Sometimes that's what you do. You don't sue someone and file a list pendants before you even exercise your option. You don't sue someone and file a notice of list pendants before that option is rejected wholly. And you don't sue someone and file a notice of list pendants after the sale took place, because by then it's too late. So you have sometimes a very narrow window in which you have to file a notice of list pendants and file that lawsuit. So sometimes you do it in a hurried fashion. To not do that in a hurried fashion, that might be malpractice. So sometimes you find out these things are happening, and you have to preserve your client's rights by doing those things, and you have to assert them within that narrow window. So to say that that's indicative of some kind of malicious intent is ridiculous, because you can't sue at any other time except in that small window.
So why doesn't the presumption, a presumption apply here?
I'm not sure that one shouldn't, Your Honor. And with respect to the presumption, the virtue case actually says that malice cannot be implied by the communication itself. That's what it says. Malice cannot be implied by the communication itself. There is no other evidence other than the mistakes that are contained in the communication itself. And we've rebutted that presumption by saying...
So what argument are you making there, that the presumption doesn't apply because of that?
I'm arguing that I don't think that there's a presumption anyway, but even if there is, you can't derive that presumption only by the document itself, because that's a direct quote out of the case. It says malice cannot be implied by the communication itself. There must be other things. So I don't think that there is a presumption. I don't think that that's what that case says. Now, I've raised this in the brief, but a presumptive, this idea that they're afforded a presumption was never argued in the lower court. I don't think it's proper before this court, but I'm throwing that out there. But even so, it just doesn't apply. It doesn't work.
So if we found that there was a presumption, how have you rebutted it?
That is well laid out in both my brief as well as the court's opinion, the lower court's opinion.
Lower court didn't address the presumption argument.
What I did say, well, you're right, but what the court did recognize was a good faith effort. So in that way, they did rebut, it did lay out how that presumption would be rebutted by establishing that the court found that there was a good faith effort made, that the filing of the action was made in good faith. It did that by laying out all of the claims and noting that the court found that this was a tricky and complicated, complex legal issue as to whether or not that purchase option could be enforced by Mr. Dierdal. The court from which this appeal is being taken noted throughout its determination, and I find it hard to believe, whether that's right or wrong, a judge made that same conclusion, that this was a tricky issue. So to say that there was no basis at all just rings silent. And so Larry McDowell did go through and state what the grounds of that case was. Nothing has been brought up to counter that. If we're framing this, and I don't think that it is, but if we are framing this as a presumption that was rebutted, nothing shifted and nothing has come back, except for there were some errors in it. Again, that's the communication itself. Nothing else has been pointed to. There is no other evidence of that malice. And they have pointed to none other than the communication itself that contains the errors.
And your point is that the communication itself, by itself, can't establish the presumption.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's flat out in the virtue case. But even, the case fails anyway because there's that disconnect between the damages and these so-called false statements. There still is that big disconnect. The fourth element is the publication of the false statement concerning the title to the property caused the damages themselves. There is nothing anywhere that says that it was because they got the wrong county listed or because there was a couple days discrepancy between when the notice of list pendens was filed and when the action was commenced. Those are the false statements, and there is a disconnect between those supposed false statements and the damages. That disconnect is fatal because the element is that the publication of the false statement, not of the document itself, but the publication of the false statement caused the damages. There is no indication in any arguments or otherwise that it was the supposed false statements. You know, the purpose of filing a list pendens is to serve warning that title to property is in litigation and impedes a property owner's right to free alienability of real estate. That's the purpose. I understand that there are flaws in it. I understand that it was, according to the statute, an operative document. But it served that purpose. And so if there was people who did not want to rent, it wasn't because they got the county wrong. If people decided that they wouldn't rent the case, rent land because it was tied up in litigation, it was because it was tied up in litigation. And the notice of list pendens provided notice of that. And it was tied up in litigation. There was a lawsuit for years on this thing. So that disconnect is fatal to this, and it's a sleight of hand. What opposing counsel will try and argue is that the false statements, that there was a false statement in these errors. The false statements were published. The document was filed maliciously, not the false statement, but the document was filed maliciously, and the document caused the damages. That is much different than the false statement causes the damages. And that's what the lower court found. Found all kinds of reasons why that this is not a slander of title case. It just doesn't fit. The damages were not caused by these types of mistakes. Your Honor, real quickly on the malpractice case, I would just simply note that I think you've got it, but malpractice cases are absolutely about how the damages occurred in the first case. It is not up to a jury in a malpractice case to determine how damages should have been apportioned or how it should be or how the first jury might have done it. It is absolutely about what would have been different. That is the but-for case. That is the but-for test, that the outcome in the first case would have been different but for the mistakes made by the accused attorney. There is no mechanism and no way to make that determination. They could have. I understand. You know, I think Mr. McLaughlin was in a tough bit. I'm not sure I would have picked up on that either. But the fact is that going back now, we can't do that. We can't go back and determine how it would have been different. And that is required. That is what the malpractice case, that's what a malpractice case is. It's not to start a new case, who might come up with a completely different outcome, be considering, especially since we have two different judges that are looking at this case completely different. A new jury may not even find any. But that's not what a malpractice case is. So, Your Honor, I would just respectfully request that the court upheld or affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal? And if so, would you let us know who will be giving the rebuttal for appellants?
Your Honor, we would like a minute on behalf of Mr. Dierdall. This is Dave McLaughlin speaking, and then Mr. Steiner can have the rest. So that's okay?
That's fine. Let's just set the clocks here. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Basically, I have just a couple short responses. Basically, Mr. Dierdall is not seeking all of the damages which were assessed against him in the underlying case. This case claims $34,947, which is damages from the 2011 crop year. So if there's other damages out there, that's not what Mr. Dierdall is claiming. And then another rebuttal would be that we were forced, because of Mr. McDowell's actions, to stand in front of the jury and admit, yes, the list of defendants was filed, it was incorrect, and from that point on, you've already put yourself halfway in the grave when that happens. So that's, and we couldn't get out of the case. So that's our rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much.
And Your Honors, I just want to touch on a couple of things. A false statement, Minnesota's case law has already defined what that is. Recording a false statement that's not entitled to be recorded is a false statement. Contrary to McDowell's belief, it is a false statement. And there are other false statements as well. The fact that it was represented that a lawsuit was filed in another county. The fact that it said a lawsuit is already pending. All false statements that just go to show that there's just a malicious intent or complete reckless disregard in completely crafting his lawsuit. That's why he spent 48 minutes drafting his lawsuit and summons a complaint, the notice of pendants, and all the legal research. 48 minutes. That's what recklessness is in a case like this involving a property worth nearly $1 million. It's a big deal. Now, this whole issue with Mr. McDowell's bringing up now with there's no evidence of causation of damages, well, this isn't even a basis for summary judgment on the lower court. So we object to it and ask the court sustain that objection.
Can I ask a quick question
also,
here?
Also, the prior litigation just
to ask, make... May I ask a quick question here?
Yes.
So did you argue the presumed malice to the district court?
It was already argued. It was argued. I don't know the word presumed or implied or anything like that was used. I'm not sure. But it was argued. We spent a significant amount of time on the effect of this document that wasn't entitled to be recorded, this false statement. And the McDowell's counsel argued that it's irrelevant or it doesn't matter. And we believe it is relevant because it does go to the rebuttable presumption. And this is a case which... counsel and everyone, we all were cited aggressively, so it was certainly wasn't a mystery. In terms of what happened in the lower court, I just want to make clear too, in the first case, my client had filed a counterclaim to quiet title and to declare adverse interest in the property for declaratory judgment. Mr. Dierdall's claims, all of them, dismissed on summary judgment. My client's claims, all granted on summary judgment, except for slander title. And then I think one other claim, which is for breach in the event that there was a contract, which was moot. So all those claims were swept up based on undisputed facts. And the court in that case did a remarkable job with his decision in citing the case law on it. There's nothing else that could have been argued on it. But let's touch on this ratification theory that we're now hearing about again. The Gressler case has facts which are eerily similar to this one. They're very similar, involving agents. And the court said a couple of things. Said when the original authorization itself must be in writing, the ratification must be in writing as well. And what that means is if Mr. McDowell right now is going to claim that somehow the trust attorney had ratified this or someone ratified this bogus contract to sell and liquidate for 68 cents on the dollar, somehow, if that's true, there has to be written authority for that. This is a statute of frauds issue. And statute of frauds is very well established. And also the fact that there's a check, I don't know what this has to do with, but that same case, basically, it said that the mere delivery of a check as earnest money is insufficient to constitute a benefit. That's irrelevant. A check was not cash. It was there was some confusion as to whether there's a different property involved and a completely different trust. And I think the attorney wasn't sure what he was talking about. And keep in mind that Mr. McDowell and his counselor, or his client, are doing this on the eve of my client's dead parents' estate, and they have to deal with this and learn what had happened and some of the background on it. And the attorney did too. He had to get caught up to speed. So this whole thing that my clients had full knowledge of what was going on, and which is what ratification requires, is nonsense. And that's why the court dismissed it. We did not seek sanctions in that case, but we very well might have. And the Smith versus Toomey case, an attorney was held liable for this exact same conduct by the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you all for the arguments and the briefing. It was very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement, and a decision will be issued in 90 days.
Your Honor, do we drop off here, or?
I think that you can just go, and then they'll take care of it all.
Okay, I think you can just go.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.